Peter, this proposal, at least part of it, is going to the Board of Supervisors on the 27th. What do you predict is going to happen there?
Well, partly because we're trying to be shrewd these days rather than confrontational, at some psychological cost to ourselves. We approached the supervisors through their financial supporters, and we actually have got a pretty good hearing. So I think at the moment we have the support of at least three of the five supervisors for this experimental parking site. And I actually think that'll go through. We have contacted here an organization called Catholic Charities, which we feel is superior in its treatment of the poor to the local St. Vincent de Paul. And we're having Catholic Charities carry this proposal to the supervisors. Now, they're a reputable organization who have dealt with Anglo and especially Hispanic poor for many, many years, so we think this is a point in our favor. We have raised enough private money, or have the promise of private money, so the county could do this if it insists without cost to itself. But we also have approached mental health department in the county, and they're interested in partially funding this. The argument being, by the way, that many people on county rolls, on SSI or SSDI, or going through the county mental health system, cannot find housing anywhere, so this would be of use to people the county is taking care of. And I think this has a good chance of working out. I believe there'll be a certain amount of community reaction to it. But not as much as there's going to be to the notion of people parking all over the county on church sites. So these are sort of separate proposals, and I think the experimental site may stand a good chance of working its way through the system to actuality.
Santa Cruz has had, since 1995, an exception for churches, and since 1999, an exception for businesses that have allowed 3 and 2 vehicles, respectively, to park on church and business property with the written permission of the church or the business. And unfortunately, not too many churches have jumped on board, and even less businesses, I understand. Do you have any indication that you're likely to get a more friendly climate?
No, I think that's interesting. One is I'm interested to hear that they have had such an ordinance, and my second reaction is yes. We have not been, to the extent that we've tried to approach churches, we have not been overwhelmed with the response. I think what may happen is that churches whose parishioners fall on hard times or are on hard times may agree to do this. What we have found is that the poorer churches, which tend in our town to be sort of evangelical churches, are likelier to do this than others because they're used to the idea of poverty and people in immediate need. My sense is that our churches, being even slightly more upper class than Santa Cruz churches, right, are not likely to respond any better than your churches have. And of course, this is astonishing to me. When I run into this, I put my new learned civility aside and just try to explain to people the ways in which they're violating the tenets of their own faith.
Right.
But that doesn't get you very far either. It certainly doesn't turn them around.
Right.
Well,
in Santa Cruz, we've had in Santa Cruz since 1987 or 88 the so-called Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which prior to the use of the armory was the only shelter for people, and it's a very limited shelter, but every night two churches rotate. I think you got a 10 or 12 different churches, and two churches rotate so that in the summer you can get, I think it's 26 people or 28 people on the floor of a church per night, or two churches, and then in the winter there are two more churches involved. They have a broader number of churches, and so you have this history in Santa Cruz of the churches being involved more than, I guess, Santa Barbara, I assume, doesn't have such a policy, right?
Well, you know that basically the shelters we do have are church-run, except for Transition House. There's a Salvation Army program and a Rescue Mission program.
But those are just two particular churches, right?
But the fact is that these groups maybe for good reason, have concentrated their resources on recovery or turning people's lives around, right? I mean, it's like a system of triage. They're trying to save the people they think they can change. And that means the people on sort of permanent disability or SSI forever because of mental difficulties or just reach 50 or 55 and have to live on little Social Security payments. It means that these persons are relatively forgotten because they're never going to change their lives. There are exceptions to this, and of course, in our locality, what they've done is they set up a winter shelter, an emergency winter shelter, with civic funds, but then they leased it out to St. Vincent de Paul, that runs it as a secular shelter, but behind the way they run the secular shelter are certain religious attitudes which they have a hard time escaping. But having said that, I have to say this to you, and you must have seen the same thing. As bad as churches are, and as bad as these church-run organizations are, we don't have secular groups in our community providing alternative services. You know? I mean, there are secular groups that could enter this fray and take ideological positions or try to run things to be used by the homeless. And the fact is, as bad as they are, the only people who bother with this are the churches.
That's, I think, largely true in Santa Cruz as well, though there is a homeless services center which kind of, well, gets funding from a variety of sources, state, federal, local, and private. And they don't have shelters, but they have lockers and telephone service and meals during the day and things of that sort. So, but yeah, I think the same thing is true, that the churches have taken the major role, you know, small as that role may be in terms of the need. You know.
I know, and that's a little scary. I mean, what happened is, you will remember very recently when George Bush began this notion of, or to talk about implementing the notion of church-based services, and the government funding them. Of course, all my liberal friends were up in arms, as probably they should have been, but I kept trying to remind them, you know, that as liberals, all they'd ever done was, at the most, if they did that, was to sort of argue that the federal government should throw more money at this problem, but that the people really doing the day-to-day hands-on stuff, that is working in the soup kitchen or running the kitchen down at the shelter or bringing clothes down to the shelter, were much more often than not religious people.
Santa Barbara has also had a history of homeless activism almost unique in its intensity, partially because Ronald Reagan had his summer home there, and partially because people like Kit Tremaine, a wealthier woman, donated a lot of money, and you had homeless activists organizing extensively during the 80s. Mitch Snyder's Creative Community for Nonviolence Project targeted Santa Barbara as the town to eliminate the sleeping ban, and you did successfully eliminate it for about 3 years after a massive threat of input from or ingress. A bunch of homeless people are going to come to town and go to sleep, go to jail at the Fig Tree. So you're kind of in a unique town in that respect. You have that history. There wasn't a homeless activist group, Homes on Wheels. I guess Nancy McCready and Susan Dunn were part of it. They were trying to get the city to license vehicles, and they failed, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, permit them to park in different places. Homes on Wheels still around? Is anything
it's
happening?
Still around, but no more effective. It's a very small group. I mean, I'm going to say several things in answer.
Sure.
Some of which may sound a little tired or skeptical. I mean, one thing we found, and I love Nancy and I love Linda, right, is that of course, homeless people, as good as their hearts are not real good at organization. They tend to want all new people coming into an organization to adapt to their way of doing things. I mean, I'm exactly the same way myself, so I understand this. We keep our organization small so we don't have to deal with a large number of people and get them to agree about anything. But what's happened in Santa Barbara is whenever the homeless, and I've seen this over and over, they'll go before the city council to talk about changing the sleeping law. And half of them will get up and say, we want you just to eliminate the law so we can sleep anywhere. And the other half get up and say, no, we don't want that. We want a site for sleeping. And by the time you finish this discussion or this protest, there have been so many ideas thrown into the air that it's easy for the city council to ignore them all. And it's very hard to get past that. I mean, largely because homeless people have this problem on their own. Each person, quite rightly, thinks up an ideal solution and then brings it forward to the city council. But usually these proposals are so ideal that nobody has to listen to them. I'm just going through that right now. We're trying to represent and work with a group of people out in Isla Vista who want not just a parking site for vehicles, but want the city planners to provide a park in which you can sleep and camp lawfully. Now, that's obviously the right idea, and any just community would have such a place. But the fact is, we're never going to have such a place. So what you're faced with here is the choice between, and it really is a terrible choice, the choice between insisting endlessly on what a community should do, but what it's easy for them to dismiss, or insisting on what they can or might willingly do, which is always far less than what they ought to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this presents a problem not just to advocates, but a particular problem to homeless people. And what I like about them, but at some point find ineffective, is the perpetual insistence on an ideal solution, right? And that means, in a terrible way, that nothing gets done. And I think politics has become for me exactly what they always said it is. It's the art of the possible. It's cutting deals with people so you get 20% of what you want, right? But 20% gets done.
Is this the firebrand Peter Maron who...
Well, I was about to say that I find this form of behavior immensely exhausting and dissatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And there is obviously, you could argue philosophically or spiritually that there's something infinitely superior about the prophetic voice, right?
Right.
Which actually reminds people endlessly of what ought to exist.
Well, maybe both need to exist, you know?
But yeah, but we have a small number of people at this point in time who are trying to do both.
Right.
And that includes me, and includes Nancy, and includes Linda. The numbers are so small that you can't do both.
Hmm.
And that's a real problem. I mean, you can't do both because in the prophetic voice, you don't just utter what ought to exist, but you tell people about how they are morally or individually or institutionally screwing up.
Yep,
right?
Yep.
And of course, people are so mad about power, people on something like the city council or the supervisors board, that as soon as you start to tell them how they're screwing up,
They turn off completely.
They turn off, right. And so you have to flatter them, and you have to be civil, and you have to come in the right clothes, and you have to use the same tone of voice. We have an intermediary to the city council who always brings me back news about how happy the mayor, Harriet Miller, is with my new demeanor.
I see.
And that makes it likelier they'll do something, but not a lot.
The same Harriet Miller who was on the council in the 80s when they voted to end the sleeping ban briefly, right?
Yeah, but you see, the point is, the trick here is mm-hmm. that you get drawn in because you get a little, right? If you don't behave well, you get nothing.
Uh-huh.
If you behave well, you get maybe a little. But the little always falls far short of what people need or what would be just.
Are you getting a lot of flack from the homeless community for, quote, selling out? Or?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't get flack for selling out. We get flack because we'll say, well, you know, if we have a parking site, it's going to have to be run by some organization, right? And mm-hmm. people will say, well, I don't like that organization because they don't treat the poor the way they should. And that's probably true. And then people will say, well, why can't we run it ourselves? And the reason they can't run it themselves is, A, because they have no insurance, and B, because the county would never agree to it.
Mm-hmm. Although you did have, I guess, sort of self-managed homeless services around the Armory in the late 80s.
They were managed by the Homeless Coalition.
Right.
Which actually managed to put in place... Jane Hagstrom, you will remember,
mm-hmm.
As running the shelter, but even to this day I get complaints about Jane. I mean, not necessarily legitimate complaints. I mean, look, the poor people are so harried and so screwed over
mm-hmm.
and live lives of such stress and probably such controlled anger or repressed anger, right, that a lot of this comes out not in everybody, but in a certain number of people in any situation. You've seen this. We would go to the city council, and there'd be a dozen soft-spoken people making very legitimate and quiet and pacific arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd get James drunk or Ed Manning shouting, right?
Or here in Santa Cruz, Michael Tomasi.
and they're always making a legitimate point, but the whole thing disappears.
Right.
So I'm going to be frank here. When I put this organization together, I intentionally steered clear of making common public cause with the traditional homeless advocates. And I myself would try to send people in my place to talk to the supervisors or the city council so these suggestions wouldn't be unfairly tainted with the opinions that people had formed of me, right,
mm-hmm.
or Ed Manning, or even of Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen this. The
activity itself
becomes so ritualized, right, for mm-hmm. everybody. I mean, for the homeless, it's a very useful ritual to go before the city council and vent their anger and make their proposals.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes like theater. And then the city council responds as if it was theater. So then they play their part,
mm-hmm.
right? And strategically, the trick seems to be to break through the ritual so nobody could fall back on their habitual responses.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're talking to Santa Barbara advocate, activist, and writer Peter Marin about a proposal coming before the Santa Barbara City Council, I guess the Board of Supervisors, on the 27th to set up a safe sleeping zone or a safe parking zone for homeless folks during the night, and also to adopt, I guess, to some extent, the Eugene model, which would allow various small safe sleeping areas around the city. Do I have that right, Peter?
That's right.
Wow. I mean, I've got a lot more questions I want to ask you, but I think we may have exhausted our time and some of the endurance of some of the listeners because we've been going on for about 45 minutes.
It's quite possible.
But I really appreciate your running the details by on this, and I want to get back to you if I can in a week or two to get not just an update, but to cover some of the areas we haven't been able to cover.
Okay. Let me say one more thing.
Sure.
Apropos of what I was saying before, because whether the listeners are interested is another question, but I think you will be.
Okay.
We have this guy who goes into court for us, right? And he will say to me all kinds of things about the police or the judges when we're not in the courtroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after the courtroom, we'll turn to one another and say, what an asshole, or this or that.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's in the court, right, he observes all the necessary forms of judicial behavior and respect.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he doesn't, he'll lose the cases, right?
Right.
So what I've learned is when working with the city or county, you must do something similar,
mm-hmm.
even though it's hateful. I mean, I'm now thinking of going to live in Mexico 8 months of the year merely to escape from this identity I've created for myself because it's such a false and absurd one.
The new Peter Marin.
No, it's not new, but you've been in situations like this. You bite your tongue, and by not speaking the truth, you make yourself a little sick.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's only by not speaking the truth that's in your mind that you can get something done. And I'm sure advocates all over the country understand something about this, especially in a place where, like Santa Barbara, we don't have the numbers at the moment to do much more than this.
I think that's a key part of it. I mean, here in Santa Cruz, we have a group going to Santa Cruz City Council on the 27th to look for reopening the debate around finding some solution to the sleeping ban as a human rights issue, and partially focusing on the possibility of some social services in terms of vehicular living somewhere. But they are a group that is calling themselves the Mainstream Advocates, mainly because they want to distinguish themselves from some who are perceived as more radical or more militant, like myself and others.
Yeah.
And what we have here, however, I don't know if we have enough people to do it, but I think they are benefiting from the fact that the militants seem to have expanded the territory. Now they're going to come in, hopefully, and make maybe proposals that share a lot in common with militant proposals, but that are done in a different fashion and, you know, by different individuals who have more, quote, credibility and that sort of thing, you know.
I think this is the way it has to be done. At least, I don't know what numbers you have there, but we don't have enough to really influence the effect of elections. I mean, this is one of the, we're going to go on too long, but this is one the ultimate problem for me is that there's not enough citizenry who care about these issues, which is scary, to make it a sort of public political issue. And therefore, there's no pressure whatsoever on politicians to respond to these requests.
Interesting. We may have more of that here, although we have never had enough. We've had two initiative drives to put the sleeping ban repeal on the ballot, and we did get thousands of registered voters signing, but we didn't get enough. Partially, I thought this was not because of lack of public sentiment, but because of lack of organizational power and financing. But we would still have a hell of a job in a public campaign with real estate interests against us, no question about it, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, also, you need people with special skills. I don't think we have them. I mean, whenever I have to get on the phone and invite people to come to a meeting, you know, to back us up, you know, I wonder where all those organizationally skilled people are who really not only know how to do this but like doing it. I should add that we have gotten the theoretical support of the Citizens Planning Association, the League of Women Voters, and the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
For a resolution, at least, to the problems with vehicles. So we're not awful at organizational skills, and we're not without public support.
And in Santa Cruz, similarly, organizations like the Santa Cruz Action Network, which elected 5 of the 7 city council members, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the CalPERG, the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, Green Party, Peace and Freedom Party, all these groups have sort of signed on. But when it gets kind of hot and touchy, and city council members start turning away from these issues, we haven't had these parties calling the people to account and saying, "Hold it! You had an election promise; you have to keep it." And so we are in this position where, you know, people tend to get soft there and turn tail.
Well, I know you won your victory and then you lost it back pretty quick.
Yeah, the safe sleeping zones of last summer.
Yeah.
We're hoping again that we're going to raise these issues again and answer all the concerns yet another time. But again, the same problem or the same conditions, not that different. Ours is a smaller town, but, you know, we're seaside, we have rents escalating through the roof. I mean, it's the same deal.
You're not still as rich as we are.
That's true. You should send us some of your money.
No. The citizens should send you the money. I mean, you don't. We are now being inundated by .com.
But the same. Exactly. Silicon here is doing the same deal.
Who are new to the town, and probably even if they weren't new, wouldn't give a damn about what's happening to poor people. I mean, I call this Aspenization, you know, the fact that if you don't stop it somehow, the town's going to become like Aspen with very rich people, and then a small ring of people living in trailers and cars in some other community who service the rich.
Exactly. And that is, I think, not just here and there, but who knows? Maybe everywhere is maybe a little strong, but many places.
Anyway, I don't want to bore your listeners.
You're never boring, Peter. It's just we got a bunch of other people to cram in here. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. If people want to get in touch with you, you can certainly give a local call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will take down your name and number, and next time I talk to Peter, pass on the information. Do you want to give a phone number down there?
I can give our office phone number.
Okay.
It's 805-560-6062, and there's always someone in the office between 10 in the morning and noon.
And this is the organization called?
The Committee for Social Justice.
Hey, thank you very much, Peter, and we'll be doing this again soon if you're patient with us.
Okay, Robert, keep up the fight.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And back with open phone lines at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, phone number 427-3772, 427-3772.
Some of our public people that are here now.
Okay.
And I would like to see them speak up and speak for their rights, being homeless. I would really appreciate a lot more people speaking up to be homeless, because I'm tired of getting trashed by the city. I mean, I can do this, but I can't do that, but I can do this, but if I do that, it's illegal.
You're talking about sleeping and doing things like go to the bathroom, but there are no bathrooms around.
Well, yeah, it's like they had restrooms 24 hours. 7 days a week. A lot of cities do have that, and they patrol them regularly, so they're kept up, you know, not only with maintenance but with police. And it's a place where you can go urinate, take a shit, which is a gift for a homeless person that ain't got a shit out in the woods. Get what I mean? You know, it's like, hey.
I do. There are such porta potties downtown, but I don't think there's much in this area.
No, they lock them up at night. Yes, they do.
They downtown they do that? I thought they were 24-hour downtown.
Some of them I've noticed been locked.
Really? Interesting.
Late at night, after 2.
Huh.
Yes.
Interesting. I know that they were supposed to be 24-hour.
Well, I ate some bad food last week, and I went to 3 of them that I knew of that were public restrooms, and they were all locked up.
And that was a bit of an interview with a man out at the Homeless Services Center a couple of weeks ago who previously, I guess, worked at the Armory. And he claimed that the restrooms, so-called porta-potties, they call them restrooms, are actually the porta-potties downtown, are now locked at night from 2 to 6. When I talked to Matt Farrell of the Public Works Department, the head of the Crone Crapper Commission, the group that put in these porta-potties, he claimed that they were still open. So we'll have to do a shit-in at one of these days to figure out what's going on. And we have the shit-slinger of all time, that notorious Richard Quigley, on the line with us. Hi, Richard.
Hey.
And Richard, you're of course, you're even more formidable in person and when you're on our television show, or when I've had the pleasure of interviewing you on someone else's television show, actually. But you are a man who's had some recent success with the Take Me to a Magistrate defense. Is that right?
Well, no, not me. Lord, no, I'm not a lawyer, man. They don't listen to anything until it comes from a lawyer, didn't you? Yeah. But Kate Wells has. She's done a real good job with that. I've been singing that song for, oh, Lord, 10 years.
And tell us a little bit about the song for those who don't know the tune.
Well, it is a fact that in California, whether the government, and you want to see them roll their eyes, just mention this reality, but by the supreme law of the state, which is the Constitution, we are all, our status is free and natural persons. And so when Johnny Law wants to talk to us, what he's got to do is he's supposed to ask politely, and of course he's got to climb over our status as those who don't have to answer to anybody if we're not bothering anybody. So they keep devising these various ways, as you're well familiar, to do that. The legislature, however, because they've got to remain true to the Constitution, put in safeguards against abuses of power and process. And if the courts were to follow them, it'd make it a whole lot better. One of those is contained in the Vehicle Code, and it's Vehicle Code Section 40302C, I believe is a subsection. And what that has to do with is when an officer stops you, that's considered in California to be a technical arrest. In order for a police officer to arrest you without a warrant, they've got to catch you pretty much in the act of committing a misdemeanor or a felony, so that you're not arrestable for an infraction, which most vehicle code violations are. At the time that the officer makes this arrest, seemingly to write a ticket, because they never mention to you that something that you've done might be dangerous and maybe you'd want to think about it before you continue on. That was their original purpose, but they don't do that. They start this stuff about they're going to write you a ticket. And, of course, once you sign that ticket, it has been found, in this county anyway, to be a complaint. So now you're signing your own criminal complaint. And that sort of strips you of your rights when you go into the process to deal with the corpse. So what I recommend that people do, or have recommended for years, is that they invoke their right under the provision that says under 40302C that upon demand you're to be taken immediately to a magistrate. Now the practice for responding to that in Santa Cruz County is that they take you promptly to jail and book you. The law has been repeatedly evaluated by the higher courts, and they've repeatedly stated that that's not supposed to be done under any circumstances. Anyway, I took that to them a couple of years ago, and they chose to ignore it. And Kate Wells, who I've known for a long time, became familiar with this back in the early days when I was dealing with it. And a couple of years ago, or a year ago or so, one of her clients had been made that demand. And they didn't do that. They locked him up, and he had money. So he hired her to go into federal court and get some money back, and the result of that is that they are now instituting a process to take you to a magistrate in the county. How's that for in a nutshell?
That's a good summary, but how did you first get interested in all this, Richard?
I ran it. You mean the 40302C process?
Uh-huh. The take me to a magistrate idea.
Yeah, I ran into a guy by the name of B.E. Smith, who, by the way, this other fellow that eventually got to federal court with Kate studied under him years later. But B.E. had come to town to talk to a bunch of people, but I studied under him. And B.E. is a guy that went through and started reading the law relative to all these things, because he had a curiosity about how we could just be pushed around if we are in fact free and natural persons, how people get to walk up to us and order us around like we're chattels. That disturbed him, so his direction in dealing with that was to go in there and study the law. And in studying the law, he found out about these safeguards that the legislature put in for us, and has subsequently found out that the courts tend not to regard those things that are there to protect us. So he's sitting in jail right now, but that's a whole other story.
Medical marijuana is the reason he's in jail. And that indeed is a story we've covered a little bit on Free Radio, but not a lot. You frequently are involved, not frequently, but certainly regularly are involved in going to court to try to reclaim some of your rights, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, at this point, I'm not even doing that anymore. I don't anticipate that that's going to happen when I go into court. What I go into court for now is to build a record of how it is that they refuse to acknowledge that I have rights and follow the law in disregarding those rights. They refuse to follow the law in disregarding those rights.
This is a record for future archaeologists, or
it's kind of hard to say what good it will do. I think it's one of those things that if there is ever a day of judgment and they actually, the people get together and try these bastards for treason, it'll just add to that lump. The pile is large enough now that I'm just about ready to wander over to federal court with a long train of abuses suit, but it's still a little early. The federal courts generally don't get involved in this kind of behavior until it's just, I mean, way, way, way over the top, and they're just taking little bites at me. They haven't really gotten to the point where they can just on any single event be dragged into federal court and successfully challenged. But if you stack all the little stuff that they've been doing all along, if you can call any disregard of the law little, but these minor events, if you stack them all together, then you get what the federal courts regard as a long train of abuses. And when you can show a long train of abuses over a period of years, and I got 15 of them stacking up and probably particular incidents, no less than maybe 30 mm-hmm. over the last 15 years.
Yeah, I got 30 over the last year in the city council, but that's another story.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's typical. I mean, I'm sitting there on appeal right now having the appellate division of the Superior Court uphold a decision from the lower court that is founded on a decision that is backed with, when I asked him, when he denied my motion made on some legal grounds, I said, the plain language of the statute notwithstanding, he said, right, and that should pretty much sum it up.
Let's get back to take me to a magistrate, because if this consent decree actually happens, and if the court does provide, the jail, I guess you might say, and the court provides a 24-hour magistrate for people to be taken to, How would you recommend people deal with this if they are, for example, cited for sleeping? You stated that the vehicle code has these provisions, that you have the right to be taken to a magistrate rather than wait 48 hours to be booked or, you know, and then go to a court.
Yeah.
But what about a homeless person who's suddenly told by one of Sergeant Baker's people or, you know, one of the local officers, one of Seeley's people, that you're under arrest for a ticket, or you have to sign this ticket because you're sleeping illegally.
Well, what kind of ticket is it?
It is an infraction ticket under Municipal Code 6.36.010A.
Right, but what kind of ticket is it? Is it just a regular ticket, like they use it for traffic if they weren't using it for that? Because
no, it's not a regular. It is a citation for a criminal infraction.
Oh, so it's not laid out like a traffic ticket?
No.
Okay, I'm not really sure.
Okay.
I do know that if the discussion is about an infraction, that they have limited rights, certainly none to force you to do anything. And I think that but when they get ready to force you to sign something, you most certainly are at that point, you are considered in custody, because they can't order you to do anything when you're detained.
Mm-hmm.
So you most certainly have changed your status from being detained to in custody when they start ordering you to do stuff. And as soon as the issue of signing that ticket comes up and they threaten you with jail for not signing it, that's the time to invoke the demand to be taken to a magistrate. I don't know where the provisions are in the penal code that are similar to 40302C in the vehicle code,
mm-hmm.
but I'm certain that they're there. Because the legislature, when they set up these if you want to call them mild processes for infractions,
mm-hmm.
they do it with an eye to the fact that we have every right not to be abused by this process of infractions. And infractions are nothing. They're usually something that you can't even get into except by contract. I don't know what kind of tickets are writing down there in town that they call infractions, that sleeping ban tickets and all. Nobody's ever attempted to lay one of those on me.
Well, you should try sleeping out for a while. We'll provide you with a vehicle, and you can snooze downtown and get a little hands-on experience.
Well, I understand that you're not allowed to sleep at night downtown.
You're not allowed to sleep at night anywhere in Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock.
Well, see, that's a problem for me, because that's not being a vampire. I normally, sleep during the night.
Well, I'm sorry, Judge Kelly, in a case which Kate Wells brought to him claiming that the sleeping ban was unconstitutional in 1996, ruled a year later that no, it was constitutional because homeless people could sleep during the day and they didn't need to sleep at night. So you can put that in your pipe and smoke it. We're talking to Richard Quigley, man about the Santa Cruz courts, and a man with his own particular baseball cap bike helmet, or a motorcycle helmet, you might say.
Yeah.
You also spoke, when you spoke to me earlier, I don't know if you want to repeat this, you talked about how you you had some comments about the local courts and...
Well, I was... when I went back in 19... very late 97, early 98, I started talking about running for sheriff again in 98, because it was clear that these substations were going in the neighborhoods, and one had showed up in Aptos, and the harassment from that station had started. And it started looking like I was going to have to bring it to the attention of the people, and the best way for me to do that is to run for public office. So I started talking about running for sheriff again in 98, and oh boy, I mean, Tracy don't like the idea of having to campaign even against a write-in candidate.
Sheriff
Mark
Tracy.
Especially me, because I'm pretty direct, and he's had to face some questions he never had to face except unless I was around, so... Whoever it is that protects him, or whether he supervises, I don't know. The short version is that I found myself in jail within about, I'd say a week to 10 days from the time that I announced that I was going to run.
Weren't you also told you needed to have some sort of law enforcement experience to run?
Well, that's another story, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they put that in after I ran in 94. They put that in 95 or 96.
But you were running anyway, right?
Trying to take away our right to vote for whoever we choose for sheriff. They can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we'll get to that one day. Anyway, so I ended up getting convicted for driving while my license was suspended, because there's a question about whether or not my license had been suspended that I couldn't get fixed any way I'd ever tried in the courts. So I waited for it to become a criminal matter so I would have, all the stuff go in my favor. So from the very beginning, it was my plan on the first stop to demand to be taken to a magistrate, and the issue of whether or not I was going to, you know, my license was actually suspended, was going to be handled right then, right there in front of a magistrate. Well, in those days, what they did was take you to jail, just like they do today. They haven't instituted the lawful process yet. So I ultimately became convicted of all these things because it was, interestingly enough, Judge Kelly that didn't recognize that I had a right to be taken to a magistrate. So when they put these new, and they ripped me off on my appeal, by the way. I didn't get to do the appeal. They played a bunch of games and managed to keep from having to face it on appeal. But with this new ruling that they're coming down with, when they institute the 40302C...
And they actually set up a magistrate that people get taken.
Yeah, when they get it all set up to where they are now in compliance with the law, I will use that change in policy as the admission that they were wrong in 97 when they took me to jail instead of to a magistrate, and I'll be able to come back in and reopen that whole issue of those convictions on my license being suspended, and we'll prove that it never was, because it never was.
Do you still have a license that's supposedly suspended or not?
Oh, no. The one that I have now, at least the last time I checked, because they don't always tell you about these things the way they're supposed to. But last time I checked, it's been good for the better part of the last couple of years. But there was a period in there where it was suspended, but then they fixed that and refunded the money that they charged me because that was all a mistake. And the DMV's paying a hell of a lot closer attention to the status of my license and being proper about it than the local courts are.
Well, now, in terms of this take me to a magistrate, if people want to get more information, can I refer them to you, or are you a good resource here, or is that something you want to do?
No, it's actually my plate's pretty damn full, as you well know. I got a lot of stuff going on.
And this won't actually be coming into effect for at least a month or two. It'll take a while for the department to...
Well, they're in the process now of figuring out how they're going to comply with the law, and of course they're not going to want to comply with the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to make the minimum emotions necessary to comply with what they have to agree is the actual letter is the terms of the settlement in the federal court.
But what significance will this actually have? I mean, if you get a ticket for going through a stop sign and the cop comes up and says, okay, sign this ticket to a promise to appear in court, doesn't mean admitting guilt, what would be the point of saying take me to a magistrate?
Well, the first thing is that, like I told you, they use that complaint that ticket as a complaint further down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they trap you into having to deal with them is that you sign that thing saying you'll promise to appear, that the alternative being that they'll throw you in jail. If you go to a magistrate, you can call on the magistrate to have a probable cause hearing as to the arrest
mm-hmm.
that brought you there. Well, since it's an infraction matter, there is no jurisdiction to allow him to arrest you. So they'll have to instruct the officer to return you to your vehicle and release you.
Without bail.
You're not, they can't post bail when they couldn't arrest you in the first place. So they have to take you back to your vehicle and release you. If they again start insisting that you sign the ticket, you again start insisting to go back to the magistrate. If you're not under arrest, you don't have to take any orders, you can leave.
So what they can do instead is, if they want to do a verified complaint before a magistrate themselves, they can get you into court.
Yep.
But they cannot, by simply issuing this citation, force you to show up in court because of your new power to be taken to a magistrate immediately.
Exactly. What they do then is they mail you the ticket. Now,
right.
If you want to go in there and respond to the ticket without an attached warrant, go ahead. But I don't recommend it. And I won't be doing it anymore in the future. Once they have this program set up, I assure you. Of course, it's pretty hard for me to get stopped anymore in this county.
Has this program been set up in any other county in California that you know of?
Oh, in most of them.
So there are magistrates on call, let's say, in San Jose or...
I don't know. I don't know about San Jose. I know that the case that the federal court actually ruled on was in Shasta County.
So in Shasta County now, people are not signing traffic tickets?
No. There's nothing. No, it doesn't change how the sheeple behave.
Right, but they have the option instead to say, I won't sign it,
take me to a magistrate.
And then once you get to the magistrate supposedly says, you don't have to sign this ticket unless the cop wants to.
Well, no, you don't have to sign the ticket in any case. What the magistrate has to decide is whether or not there was probable cause for the arrest. The first thing you do is move for a probable cause hearing.
Right, but
that's why you're there.
Won't judges normally say, the police officer, you know, saw you going through the stop sign, that's probable cause for the arrest?
No, you can't arrest somebody for an infraction.
Ah, and that's the defense. I see.
Since it's not a misdemeanor, they got to take you back to your car and let you go. And they can mail you the ticket. But I don't see any way in the world that they can force you to sign your own, what ultimately ends up being your own criminal complaint.
It's interesting that you should say that, because in infractions that are non-vehicular, they also insist people sign, even though there's a claim that with infractions there's no basis for a custodial arrest unless a person isn't committing some other misdemeanor crime.
Well, no, their claim is unless they refuse to sign the ticket. Mm-hmm. And that's why you invoke your right to be taken to the magistrate instead. It's like Kate's client pointed out, when the city was having a little trouble, they kept asking him, well, then when you demanded to be taken to a magistrate, you were refusing to. No, it's like you have a menu, and you have chicken, and you have steak on the menu. If you order chicken, that doesn't mean that you're refusing steak.
Right, you're saying you will. You're not saying you won't sign the ticket. You're saying you first want to be taken to a magistrate.
I'm saying that irrespective of what I do with that ticket, I want to be taken to a magistrate. It's a different subject entirely.
But the main reason for doing it is, in fact, to say there that this whole thing, an arrest for an infraction is illegal, and this would be true in the sleeping ban, too.
Correct.
And because the arrest is illegal, you don't have to sign any ticket. If he thinks you're guilty of a crime, he can make a verified complaint in court, right?
Right. And the way that they arrest now, it's interesting, the way that they arrest you now on this ticket issue is that for not signing the ticket, they arrest you for not obeying the lawful order of a peace officer. Well, excuse me, but blowjob is as much a lawful order as signing this ticket.
Right.
You got it?
I understand your allegation. I wouldn't be advising people to do this until the magistrates are in place and until they're willing to spend the number of hours in jail. And
oh,
I myself have not gone through this process. I almost did about a month, well, actually it was several months ago, when police stopped me for allegedly going through a stop sign. And I asked, to be taken to a magistrate, and didn't quite get as far as perhaps I will the next time this happens. We've been talking to Richard Quigley. Richard, thank you very much for kind of giving us this step-by-step update on the Take Me to a Magistrate defense, which I guess now there'll actually be real magistrates in Santa Cruz County for people to be taken to. Let us know when this happens, and I'll pass out the word here on the air.
And now keep in mind that the law does not require that they have a magistrate on duty 24 hours a day. The law requires they have them on duty during, when the courts are open.
Okay.
And when they are not on duty, they have a magistrate's clerk.
Right, but it's something similar to a magistrate.
That's correct.
But
the bottom line is that if you get in the situation of demanding to be taken to a magistrate, instead of going to jail and being booked and kept there for several hours, you will be taken directly to the magistrate or the magistrate's clerk.
We hope. At least that's the plan, right?
Well, that's what they're setting up.
Well, I know that so far they have changed the form that has on, if you look on the booking form, has the suspect been advised of his right to be taken to a magistrate. There is now a box to check off. So I want to thank you and Kate Wells for getting that far with this, and I want to thank you for being on the air today, Richard.
Well, it's mostly Kate Wells and whoever her client was with the money. I didn't do anything except lose.
Well, keep up the good fight.
Yeah, thanks, bud.
All righty.
Okay.
And it's about the last 9 minutes of the good fight on this edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides here. I want to apologize right now to Christina Tafoya, who I interviewed yesterday, and we have not had time to sneak in her interview yet. She actually was going to be on the air. She is the woman who was written up in the Sentinel, I'm sorry, in the Metro, about an incident that occurred last September, apparently involving Sergeants Clark and Vogel, according to her account, in which she was held at gunpoint, taken down to the ground, had a canine unit dog barking near her and brought out of a vehicle, handcuffed, searched by a man rather than a female, and held in a vehicle for 45 minutes, only to be released with a In the Park After Dark ticket. And the park, in this case, being a concrete walkway between the two streets in the Beach Flats, Raymond's and Lee Brandt, or maybe it's Raymond and Uden Street. It's right where the community trailer is down there in the Beach Flats Community Park area. She
spoke about this on Free Radio a couple weeks ago, and her mom actually was on Thursday talking about similar problems that people of color and others in the beach flats have had to face from the Santa Cruz Police Department. She talked about that on Thursday. I'm hoping we can have, we can do this interview on Thursday when we return from 6 to 8 on Free Radio in the evening, and I would invite you to come back and hear that interview at that time. And again, my apologies, we weren't able to get it in today. We're always behind time, I'm afraid. I tend to get long-winded, and I let my guests do the same, and I think a lot of them have good things to say, and it's worth hearing what they have to say. I have here the letter to the Santa Cruz City Council, actually to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice and to the Santa Cruz City Council, dated January 24th, being circulated by the Mainstream Advocates, who are a group of people. I guess Dan Alper's on that group, Lydia Blanchard, I think Michael Schmidt may be there, Paul Brindell, respected citizens in the community. Not that some of the rest of us aren't respected as well, but let's say more mainstream citizens who are seeking, well, I'll read the letter. It speaks for itself. Dear Mayor Fitzmaurice, we urge the Santa Cruz City Council, as our political representatives, to refocus attention on the condition of the many homeless people in our community. Given the documented housing shortage, we believe that the city ordinance criminalizing homeless people when they sleep outside or in vehicles is inhumane and may be unconstitutional. We firmly request that the City Council deal constructively and soon with this pressing need for just treatment. We are united in affirming support for the Council's finding a creative, compassionate, comprehensive, and permanent solution. We urge you to address our concerns and to publicize the Council's intended hearings and actions. Many of us are willing to work with you and have provided numbers or email for you to contact us sincerely. So that is the letter from the Mainstream Advocates to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice and his council, and that apparently has several hundred signatures already. It'll be presented in detail on February 27th, the evening session of City Council. That's a week from Tuesday, assuming that as planned, that goes on the agenda in apparently an action to be undertaken by new council member Ed Porter, about whom I've had good and bad things to say in the last few months, mostly bad things about the entire City Council because of their failure to address this criminalization of the poor issue, which is long, long overdue and needs to be dealt with. If you want to sign this or get a copy of this petition to circulate, you can call HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I have a couple copies of it. It is not the official HUF position, by the way. HUF itself, I think it's, as a HUF member, we haven't actually had a specific meeting on this petition, but my understanding to talking to a couple of HUF members is it's pretty weak. And we don't think it may be unconstitutional to criminalize homeless sleep at night. It is unconstitutional. If, in fact, judges so far refuse to recognize it, that's their problem. The Constitution is pretty clear about due process and basic human rights. It's clearly unconstitutional and a violation of human rights, violates UN Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Conventions, violates the state constitution's right to liberty and safety, liberty and security. It's bad. It's an anti-homeless law. It's one of these, like it's an anti-black laws were and the Jim Crow laws. It's you know, they can defend it all they want with legal tricks. The fact of the matter is it's a institutionalized hate crime against people in this community, poor people. So I don't... there are numerous aspects. I think they kind of pussyfoot around with this wording, and they should be talking about repealing the entire sleeping ban, indeed the entire camping ordinance. You can't make it criminal to put up a shelter for yourself when there's no other alternatives. Sorry, that's not something that you can do. Rich people can't do it that way, you know, much as you might want to clear everybody else out and make sure all those poor people avoid the Santa Cruz area. Can't do that. Sorry. Unfortunately, the judges don't see eye to eye with me at this time, nor does the City Council. I hope the majority of the community does, though, and that would be nice. And if you are interested in pursuing these issues, as I said, there is a homeless working group meeting tomorrow at Baker Square at 8:30 in the morning, and you're invited to it. And there's also an opportunity to be on the air. If you give a call off air to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, you can do that. If you want to be a part of the process of holding Tim Fitzmaurice, Emperor Tim, as I call the mayor, accountable for his betrayal of the Green Party platform on the sleeping ban and on other issues, give a call to the homeless working group, the Green Party homeless working group, which is another homeless working group. It's at 475-2012, 475-2012. We are at the end of our rope here, at the end of our time, and unfortunately don't seem to have gotten anywhere in terms of the many, many tapes I'd like to have played, but I guess we've gotten somewhere. I'm sorry we haven't had more call-ins. I really do invite them because I think that your voices are really, well, they're certainly more interesting than mine to me because I've heard me many a time, I'll tell you. Anyway, here's a little something to end the show with. I believe we have a little red hen. No, we have a Bound Together Bookstore is presenting a 6th annual San Francisco Anarchist Book Fair on March 24th, according to this little piece of propaganda that just slipped my way. Free admission, County Fair Building, Golden Gate Park, 9th Avenue in Lincoln, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. That's a ways off. That's a month away. So I'm going to leave this thing posted here for all the talk show folks to talk about and all the broadcasters to broadcast about. Let me ask this man who's just invaded the studio here, are you here to do a show or just... No, he's just a guest. Looks like the little red hen is late. Giving me perhaps an extra 5 minutes. Can hang out if you want. Let's hear a little a brief interview with Kevin Clark. I don't think I played this interview. I hope I haven't. Kevin is a man who ran a low-income auto dealership. It's a rentership which rented to poor people and got driven away by the city council and the machinations of, I guess it was the Au people. I guess George Au, who wanted to use his triple A auto parking lot for a parking lot for an expanded Nickelodeon. Here's a little interview about that and what's been happening with Kevin Clark lately.
February 10th, and I'm talking to Kevin Clark of what do we call your auto outfit?
It's a low-cost auto rental.
A low-cost auto rental. We're in the parking lot of the police station, which is also the community parking lot, that you wouldn't know it because I don't have a sign that tells you you can park here in any visible way. Kevin, you're mostly located in Watsonville these days after having been driven out by the expanding Nickelodeon. Recap for us before we get wet in the rain here.
Oh, yeah, okay. So they're going to buy the building. Or George Al is buying the building so that the Nickelodeon could move into the old old movie 1 and 2 theater. So they destroyed my business,
which was right next door.
Spent $500,000 in public money, stole $10 out of the pocket of every citizen in Santa Cruz for a rich, wealthy developer, and now they're not going to do it. Now they're going to spend $1 million to buy the Del Mar Theater for two rich, wealthy, Barry Swinson and George Al. And those guys will split the profits when they renovate and rent the space to the Nickelodeon Theater. Therefore, that puts George Al and that trio at about $1.5 million. You could probably come up with just George Al, maybe $3 million. They'll just pull $30 out of your pocket and send it to the city council.
They're a worthy cause. I mean, these are our own local. You aren't sending your money away to large corporations, just small local corporations.
Yeah, the million-dollar homes that they live in up on the hill, they need to finance the hot water for their pools and jacuzzis, and I know that you can afford that.
Well, I'm really impressed that you're supporting those individuals even after what they, seemingly at your own personal expense. So what about individuals who want to rent a car? What do you charge and how do they proceed?
Well, they just call me up and then we set up an appointment. I usually try to do appointments between 10 and noon and again in the evening between 5 and 7.
And the phone number to call is?
It's 457-9681.
One more time?
It's 457-9681.
We're talking to Kevin Clark. Kevin, your auto business, shall we say, been kind of going through rocky times with your you had to move from out of Santa Cruz, you moved to Watsonville, and it's not as desirable a location, right?
Well, anyone who's tried to find a place to rent here will know how almost impossible. And then my business requires a certain amount of space, and it's almost prohibitive. I'm totally frustrated.
And you're also a writer of contemporary history, and I guess you might call yourself you've written some broadsides yourself. Bathrobes Pierre, of course, has his own broadsides, name of our show here, but you yourself have written the first issue of a sort of publication, right?
Yeah, I've tried to channel my anger and rage in a positive fashion.
And the name of the publication?
It's a Santa Cruz Vigilance.
And is it likely where can you get the Vigilance?
We tried to do distributions. You might find it on your car or a car that's parked in front of you. We're just going to put them on a car.
So terrorist distribution by night, huh?
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
I see. And you think there'll be a Vigilance 2 soon?
Yeah, we're definitely going to start putting one together. There's a need for a second one.
And can people who want to contribute to Vigilance get in touch with you and leave you an article?
Yeah, you sure can. It's SC Vigilance. How do you get it? scvigilance@hotmail.com.
scvigilance@hotmail.com, or perhaps they could call you at your phone number?
Yeah, definitely. That's probably the best thing. Call me at my phone number, and I'll have you mail it to me. It's my
phone number is
457-9681.
457-9681. Thank you, Kevin, and we hope to get some of your analysis of recent city council shenanigans, if you can ever hold your water long enough to wander into city council without getting ill at the door or getting arrested.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would like to, limit anyone who goes to city council meetings regularly and knows what actually goes on there. They want to stop all those people from showing up. There's no doubt about that. Because that information available to the public interferes with
the smooth running of city council.
Yeah, their evil desires to promote the wealth of their close personal friends and themselves with it.
Certainly a damning indictment from a damn sweet guy. Thank you very much, Kevin. Anything you want to add?
No, that's pretty good.
Tuned still to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We're wandering a little overtime here, waiting to hear from the Little Red Hen and seeing if where she and Baba Yaga are. They're usually here a little early, and maybe they're delayed, and we're going to be doing a little more interviewing until we get the boot here. Here's another interview from the Homeless Services Center. Homeless person out there, Huff, actually, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group of civil rights activists, made a visit out there to do some interviewing and let people know what was going on around City Council and the Coffee Klatch 3, and here's a couple of folks' reactions to what happened.
We're talking to... what's your name?
Debbie Sheridan.
Debbie, you've been homeless for about 4.5 years?
Yeah, I have a 5-year-old son. He's been with his dad. He'll be 5 next month, so it's been almost 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And he's been with his dad because I have no home.
Right. And where do you live?
Where do I live? I live alongside the river. I live under the bridge. I live in somebody's car. I live in my car with the broken window in it. I live in any place I can find, the armory. When it's really, really cold and when it's raining, sometimes we rent U-Hauls. any place we can find.
Gotten any tickets or hassles from cops lately?
Yeah, I got hassled by the police twice in 10 days.
Tell me about it.
Once was they pulled me over. They said it was because of my seatbelt. It was pitch dark outside. So really he had no reason to pull me over. I don't have a search and seizure clause, but he tried to say that I did. They turned their canine dogs loose on my car and let them romp through my dirty laundry in the back seat. They gave me sobriety tests in the cold for 2 hours. They didn't like the way my eyes were responding to the light, so they took me up to Dominican for 2 more hours of sobriety testing. Then they took me into the jail for 5 hours, threw me out 4:30 in the morning with no jacket.
And who did this? Which police agency?
That was Santa Cruz PD did it the first time, and then the Highway Patrol did it 10 days later.
Now, are you combining the two incidents as you discussed this?
Right, well, because they were both called DUI. One was for nothing at all. One was I was on methadone maintenance. Nothing else. I gave the UA. They haven't had their test results back yet, but when they get them back, they're going to see I wasn't on anything. And the other one was for 2 shots of Rite Aid brand cough syrup. It's kind of like NyQuil. It does have a little alcohol in it. I was getting ready to go to sleep in my back seat. I had bronchitis. I showed them the bottle.
Now, were they both, one was, who, SCPD was the cough syrup cops, or was that the Highway Patrol?
The Highway Patrol was the cough syrup.
Okay, and the folks you were jailed twice for this? And
the first time they towed my car, it cost me $200 to get it out of impound. North County Towing broke my side view mirror, lost my keys, and didn't even apologize for it. They felt they didn't have any responsibility, I guess. The second time they decided to be nice and not tow my car, they locked me out of it. 4:30 in the morning, no jacket, and I couldn't get in my car.
So, and both occasions you were sent to jail and released early in the morning, or was there a difference?
4 o'clock in the morning, both times, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Where did both these incidents happen?
Emeline Street and just going up the hill on the side of the boardwalk, you know where the train trestle is, up the side of that hill.
The other side of the river? Or?
The other side, yeah, going up toward the tourist viewpoint up there.
And both these incidents happened in the early evening? Or?
Before daylight, it was right before daylight the first time, and it was after dark the second time. It was bedtime. I was going to sleep. He said he stopped me for my seatbelt. It was pitch dark when he stopped me for my seatbelt. Pitch dark. That was the Highway Patrol. That was the cough syrup incident.
If you'd like to file a complaint against the police department, we have forms available.
Well, you know, I've also been receiving letters from the DMV. Apparently, it's on a computer now. DMV spits you out a letter saying you have to come in and give them $100 or your license is suspended. This is before you go to court. Okay, so they're telling me my license has been suspended. I haven't even been found guilty or convicted of anything. Also, I've been receiving a stack of letters from lawyers. But how to survive your DUI? Apparently, everybody everywhere has access to this computer. This notice. It's great. It's great. Now I have this great reputation. I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 5 years.
I see you're drinking some sinister Pepsi beverage.
That's it. Oh, yeah, they had sinister medication bottles, too, in my car. I said, you know what? You're going through my medicine cabinet in my bathroom right now. I mean, how would you feel if somebody violated you like that? I know it's the front seat of my car, but it's also my bathroom. If, you know, as far as where I stow my things when I'm sleeping in the back seat. I don't have very much room in a Toyota.
How long have you been homeless?
This time is 4.5 years.
And you're a woman. Have you experienced any violence or threats of violence as a consequence of being homeless?
Yeah. I had my breastbone broken by a cop up in Felton for going in the dumpster after some delicious produce. This is when I first became homeless, so it was about three and a half years ago. And I was hungry. I was staying in the pastures in Felton because my son's dad lives in Felton. My son's in Felton. He was just little. He was only a year old. I wanted to see him. The only way I could see him is at the Covered Griffin Bridge Park. His dad would bring him to me. I went behind the dumpster at Safeway. The manager came out there and said, get out of that garbage. I said, this is delicious produce. Look at it. I thought some kid made a mistake. I was going to come in and tow it to you. She called the police. The policeman jerked my arm up behind my back so hard. He was way over 6 feet. So hard, my breastbone snapped. Slapped a cuss on me, threw me in the back seat. I sat back there crying, God, I didn't do anything. He came back there, he says, that's their garbage. And then he explained to me, oh, there could be mop you know, stuff dumped in there, broken glass or open pet collars.
That's why I broke your shoulder.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. That part hadn't occurred to me. All I saw was fruit and it looked good and I was hungry.
Did the cop take you out to dinner?
No, he sure didn't.
Did he get you medical care?
Oh, no, nothing like that.
Did he give you a ticket?
No, he finally took the cuffs off me and they hassled me and hassled me until I left town. I was hassled again a week later for rolling a cigarette out in the pasture. They told me I was trespassing. I said, who told you I was trespassing? I have permission to be here from the owner of his pasture. They said, no, you're trespassing. They hassled me that night.
Santa Cruz Police, Capitola Police, Sheriff's Department.
That was the green cars up in Felton. They hassled me one night coming back from seeing my son. They told me it was my lucky night and they were going to let me go. They took off my driver's license and brought it back. They thought I was under some substance, but they couldn't prove anything. I wasn't acting wrong. I didn't smell wrong. They just didn't like the way my eyes responded or the way I looked or something about my car. I think it was the way things were piled up in the back seat they didn't like. So they decided just to stop me and just give me the run through. They went through my car. Went through all my stuff, messed it up. They tore my floorboards up. They ripped my line of headliner open.
Did you file any complaints with the Internal Affairs Department about any of these incidents?
I'm under 5 mental disabilities. I have 5 mental disabilities. I'm paranoid. I'm delusional. I'm schizophrenic. I don't know who to talk to about these things. I figure it's a conspiracy against me. I really do. I had told
him. Maybe it's just business as usual. Did you ever think of that?
I told the police officer, you're just picking on a mentally ill homeless woman because you don't have nothing better to do.
But what you're telling me you believe is not a delusion, but is in fact an accurate recitation of what happened.
Well, that's where the paranoia sets in, because it does seem like a gang. I mean, there's a lot more of them than there is of me.
Are you remembering, do you think, real things that happened?
Oh, these are court accidents. I mean, there's paperwork on this. It's real. It's all real.
Do you mind if this is a free radio broadcast, if I put this out to the community?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I don't mind that.
Anything you want to add? Do you think it would be good if the sleeping ban were eliminated here in the Santa Cruz?
Yeah, I think it would, because, you know, there's not even any place to go to the bathroom around here. There's no place to even use the toilet. I had them run me out of Holy Cross parking lot, sleeping next to the church, because I was next to the porta potty because I had to go to the bathroom. I've had them run me out of the parking lot down there by Elm Street Mission because they were too full, because there was a porta potty there. It was supposed to be a public restroom. There is nowhere to go to the bathroom. Nowhere.
Now, what about downtown? I've heard actually conflicting stories that the crone crappers that were put in last year at 3 or 4 different spots downtown, are they open at night? Are they not? What's the story?
I don't know the story on that. I look and I look and I look. I can't find anywhere. I just hold it until I make myself sick. I've talked to guys that said had their legs daisy chained and were threatened they were going to dunk them in the river. The policeman down here just right over on the other side of the street, down right along the river. Just for camping. For camping.
Now, what's the last camping ticket you've heard of being issued? Heard anything recent?
Actually, I don't talk to very many people, so I don't know. I don't know.
You're very eloquent, you know.
That's why I have so much trouble. I was not always like this. I became this way from being homeless, believe it or not.
So now you should.
I put my kids in safe places first. When I first, they put me through a Social Security review hearing. I didn't understand what that was. I didn't know what that meant. All of a sudden, I didn't get a check in the mail. So I lost my place. I put my kids in safe places, I hoped. As soon as my kids were gone, I lost part of my income, made it harder for me to get a place. The minute I hit the streets, they started picking on me. The minute I got out of my home, they started picking on me. Then I was just one of the people that they hassled whenever they saw me.
How long have you been in the Santa Cruz area?
16 years. My oldest daughter is 15 years old, and she wants to finish high school with her friends. You know, I have deep roots here. I mean, if they want me to leave to go move someplace cheaper, my son is living in his grandparents' home. He's not about to leave there. He's got a sweet deal. They own that house. He doesn't have to pay anything. There's no way they're going to leave. He's got a great job. He works for the Operators and Engineers Union. You know, they're not going to let him come with me. I don't want to leave my 4-year-old. So what do I do? I can't.
Disappear into the woodwork, I guess, is the answer of the Santa Cruz Police Department and the deputy.
I asked the social worker over at the nurse's station, well, what do I do? She goes, well, what do you want us to do, Deborah? She answered my question with a question. Now, the one person who has helped me here is Karen Brock. She is Network Plus. She's tenacious like a terrier. She gets on the phone, and if she can't get an answer, she keeps going until she gets something, some kind of answer. She won't give up. She won't give up. She has all the resources in this whole place. If anybody can get to a place, Karen Brock can be. But she won't help just anybody. There's some people that are here because they want to be here. There's some people here that say, oh, home's any place where I can sleep for free. There are. And there are people that say, oh, I don't date because it's too expensive. You know, they just want to be lazy people.
On with your tale of
anyway, what I'm saying is there are people here that just hang out because it's free lunch. But there's other people like me that did not come here because they wanted to come here or because they like being homeless.
Well, the quarters are so luxurious.
Oh, exactly, exactly. You know, it's near like if you have toilet paper in the morning or a blanket at night. And that's the truth. You know, if the beans aren't warmed up, oh well. That's just the way it goes.
Thank you for this lengthy description.
Okay. Well, like I said, I wasn't always mentally ill. I got that way after I hit the streets.
Well, I
got
to tell you that you may be, quote, mentally ill, but what you've said, assuming you're being, it sounds like you're being as accurate as you know. It sounds like you're being very specific about details, and I would wager that your details are probably accurate. You're not making wild and crazy charges. You're talking about the real events that happened to you and expressing the emotional consequences that they had.
That's right.
And in fact, that interview 2 or 3 weeks ago at the Homeless Services Center was kind of backed up for me, 3 or 4 days ago when the Homeless Service Center held one of its regular community meetings, chaired by Linda Bradley, who's, I guess, involved with some of the services out there, with Karen Brock, who you heard praised, present, and numerous other folks, about 20 or 30 homeless clients. And they did state that there were just insufficient blankets and insufficient toilet paper. So the fact that she mentions these things sort of in passing and she glances over them, I get confirmation about the fact that there's virtually nothing in terms of hot meals at breakfast. There's no hot meals, that they're now only giving one serving during the evening at 4 o'clock at the meal there, that the buses are often full, that you can't get into the armory or onto the programs at night, in terms of just by programs, you know, like a roof over your head so you don't have to risk a $54 ticket or a beating or the anxiety you'd feel about police contact for whatever reason. For that most 90%, 80% of homeless people out there have to suffer, all seems to be not the ravings of a lunatic, but in fact the sad truth. Here's another interview recently.
Okay, it's about 12:30. We're outside Las Manos, the store next to the Hosts HQ downtown, on February 6th, 2001. We're talking to
Paul Reynolds.
Paul, you just showed me a letter you got with a ticket in it. Again, apparently it even has a claims violation of 5.04090. This is a letter you got in the mail, where the officer swears out a verified complaint. Actually, it's a notice of correction and proof of service. The amending officer's name is Butchie Baker, interestingly enough. He's the sergeant who is occasionally on the mall, sent to 155 Center Street, apparently an address of a friend. And this is a ticket for you, Paul, from January 26th, pretty recent, for display of merchandise by badge number 105.
And see, he changed that. The original ticket that he gave me, he didn't put that on there. The original ticket that he didn't put this.
He made some changes between
that. Some changes.
Not quite sure exactly. Oh, it should be. He changed the citation number.
He changed the citation number and he put this down without a license.
Without a license?
Without a license.
Interestingly enough. So, you remember this encounter? This happened, I guess, about a week ago.
Totally. I was sitting out in front of Roasters. Pacific Roasters. Uh-huh. And I was just sitting there making my jewelry, and I had some of my stuff laid out next to me.
Right.
And I wasn't saying anything to anybody. I wasn't like approaching people and saying I have this for sale or anything.
Right.
And I had a candle going.
Right. What time of day was it?
It was evening. It was nighttime. It had just gotten dark. And he came up and he asked me if I had a permit to have a fire.
Is this the sergeant?
Yep, this is Sergeant Officer
Butch?
Sergeant Lauren Butchie Baker.
Baker.
Perhaps.
And,
It says on the ticket.
Okay. And, he came up and he asked me if I had a permit to have a fire, to have an open fire, because I had a candle going. I said, no, I did not have a permit, and I blew out my candle. And, then he said, well, do you have a permit to sell stuff on the mall? And I said, no, but I'm not selling it. I just have it for people to look at. And he says, well, it looks like you're selling it to me. And I said, well, it's not for sale. I like to sit here and make my jewelry because it's a nice day and it's a nice place. And I like to share it with my friends. And I had gems and stones and beads out too. And I like to share those with my friends and make trades and stuff with my friends that hang out here on the mall. And I had no intent of selling it, and I did not sell any of it. And he went to the car, went back to the car, ran my name, came back and gave me the ticket.
Did he ask you for ID?
He did ask me for ID, and I didn't have ID on me. But I do have proper identification.
Uh-huh. And was anybody witnessing this?
Yeah, actually, Chris. Chris, the guitar player up there, who always plays in that little place right there.
Near Palace, yep. Former Palace Arts.
Yep, exactly, right there. He was right there, and he saw the whole thing.
And was Sergeant Baker alone, or did he have any officers with him?
He was alone. He was alone.
And did he say that he'd gotten a complaint?
No, he didn't say that he got a complaint, no.
Had he ever approached you before?
Yes, he had approached me before, right around Thanksgiving, when I first got into town. Me and my friends were sitting in that same exact spot, and him and one of the, not a town host, but the officers in the blue suits,
CSOs,
one of the CSOs came up, and they said that we're not allowed to have merchandise on display, and we said it wasn't on display, we were just making it there. Uh-huh. And at the time, he was rude to me at the time, and I said to him, well,
same sergeant.
Mm-hmm. I said to him, well, excuse me, sir, but, and then he stopped me. And he said, excuse me, what? I didn't hear you fart. I didn't hear you fart. Why'd you say excuse me? Like, that's something that a 12-year-old would say to you, uh-huh. You know? So, anyways, from that instant, like, we put all our stuff away. That was way back in Thanksgiving. Put all our stuff away, and I hadn't seen him until just now.
Had you been on the mall regularly up to that point, or not so much? Or?
Not so much, on and off, like sometimes. I have a job.
What kind of work do you do?
I'm a painter. Yep.
Painter of houses.
Yeah, I paint homes.
So this is a $162 ticket you've gotten.
Is that what it is?
Conceivably, that's the maximum.
Wow.
I would encourage you to go to court to get this. First, you go to the basement of this county building at 701 Ocean.
Yeah, I've been there twice, actually. The first time, they gave me this, which is Superior Court of California.
That I went. Okay, now you went. Had you already been arraigned on this ticket or not?
Not arraigned. What he did was, at the bottom of the ticket here, where it says when I'm supposed to appear, it says I have to appear by,
right,
he crossed out when, he said by the 26th.
Right, so you haven't been arraigned yet. What I'm going to tell you is, and I'm telling this to the audience too, who are listening, who have otherwise had problems with tickets, you want to make sure you disqualify referee John Mulligan, who would be the person who would normally hear this ticket in the basement of the county building. And the way to do that is on any day between 8 and 5, maybe 8 and 4 if you want to be safe, you go down to the basement of the county building, go up to one of the windows in the county building where they handle infraction tickets.
Yep.
You tell them you want to disqualify referee Mulligan and take the case into another court.
Oh.
You have the right to do that. They'll ask you to sign a statement that says, I swear under penalty of perjury that I believe Mulligan is prejudiced. And you can say, yeah, I do, because this weirdo on the street with the tape recorder told me that he is, and I believe everything he says.
Okay.
So,
do you have a pen?
Sure. Then when you've done that, when you've disqualified Mulligan, they will give you a bad pencil. They will give you a date in another court. And you then go to that court, you plead not guilty, and then you call Huff, 423-4833, which is the Huff line. Let us know what's going on. And not that we haven't got lawyers or anything, but we have, you know, a little experience so we can advise you as to our suggestions on how to defend yourself. And that's my suggestion to you.
And he's a judge, J-U-D-G?
He's a referee. His name is Mulligan. You want to disqualify him, and then we'll throw it into another court. And then you go to the other court, you plead not guilty, and they set trial in a week, and then you call Huff, and you talk to them about how to deal with the trial. Again, we're not lawyers. We're just people who've observed these kinds of trials before.
And the number is, for Huff, it's
423-HUFF, 423-4833. And you're tuned to the extended edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Apparently the little red hen is not around today, and we haven't heard from her. So I'm taking the time and adding a few more interviews here.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Call in is 427-3772. If you want to get in touch with us, 427-3772. Portland, Oregon is an interesting city where the Judge Gallagher has thrown out the entire camping ordinance up there, so it is now legal for homeless people to sleep in their vehicles and sleep outside, although police are finding other statutes to harass them with. One of the responses of the Portland homeless community, which has continued to be harassed, is to form a thing called Camp Dignity. Camp Dignity is described by Street Roots editor Brian Pollard, Street Roots is a homeless paper up there, in the following terms. On December 16th of last year, a small group of women and men occupying six tents set out to find welcome ground for Dignity Village. Since then, it has broken ground on four different sites, grown in size to about 35 tents, and formed a system of governance that sees to the safety of its participants. With a food preparation area, portable toilets, a storage tent, and heated watch tent, it has become a hospitable place where weary people can rest. Dignity Village, a product of the Out of the Doorways campaign, is being created to provide a safe, clean, community-based alternative for those who are currently seeking shelter but are unable to find it, according to the Dignity proposal drafted by Street Roots and City Repair Project. The campaign, initiated by Street Roots staffers Jack Tafari, Brian Pollard, Ramona Cowles, and Brent Snyder last September, was inspired by the operation of Dome Village in Los Angeles. The campaign has grown quickly and now hosts involvement from many organizations, including City Repair Project, Outside In, Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, Sisters of the Road Cafe, Martial Art Gallery, Join, Transition Projects, Inc., and the Oregon Law Center, not to mention hundreds of individuals, businesses, churches, and schools that have donated their time and energy to helping Dignity flourish. Dignity is home to an eclectic group of formerly homeless people who work together to see that everyone's needs are met. John Riesk, a disabled Vietnam vet, has been with the camp since day one and is the official marshal of the popular shopping cart parades. Organizer Jack Tafari, a Rastafarian poet and author, has been instrumental in supporting the morale and functioning of the camp and has taken charge of the sanitation. Campers Virus, JP, Tim B., and Ibrahim all contribute to safety issues. Mike Broderick, Street Roots senior vendor and poet, has also lent his support and knowledge, as has former Portland mayoral candidate Jada May Langlois, who was elected provisional mayor of Dignity Village and has shared her wisdom and stories with all. Campaign organizers hope to secure a private land donation or the funding to buy private land by this summer. There are several fundraising efforts in the works, and Reverend Ronald Williams is organizing an interracial, interdenominational banquet for the end of February, time and location to be announced. Once it has found a resting place, Commissioner Eric Sten has pledged to work with Dignity to integrate it into the continuum of services available in the city, and Bureau of Housing and Community Development officials have already started visiting Dignity's residents. For more info or to get involved, call 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and we'll give you the Portland numbers.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, just calling to find out if Becky Johnson's going to speak on the city property.
On the city property?
That sold and has become private?
I'm not sure, but I think Becky is listening to your call-in. Perhaps the thing to do is to give her a call at the Huff line, and the Huff line number is 423-4833.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
I'm not quite sure what that caller was referring to. Perhaps Becky can call in and let us know. And if she is going to speak, hey, the lines are open. And they're open for all of you out there at 427-3772. While we're waiting, here's another report from Camp Dignity from February 7th. Good morning, KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon, and IRE FM in Kingston, Jamaica. May your transmitters spread our words far and wide. Good morning, Big Issue, National Homeless Paper for the United Kingdom. Good morning, Dome Village in Los Angeles, National Homeless Coalition in Washington, D.C., and Tent City in Seattle. Good morning, Jamaica and America, Canada and England. Good morning, all poor people. Good morning, and big respect, all Dignity soldiers and crew. This is Jack Tafari from the Portland Camp Dignity on February 7th, but we have this call, and let's take it first.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I'm trying to reveal the mystery of that last phone caller.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, when I called Tim Fitzmaurice's house earlier today to tell him that we were going to be talking about that strip of land that's right along Chestnut Street, along kind of bordering along where Dr. Arnie Leff has his home and bed and breakfast on Green Street.
Now, the land allegedly from which homeless people were driven by, allegedly by complaint from the Fitzmaurices. I don't know if that's true or not. We'd hope to get a response.
Right.
Yeah.
We had hoped to hear something, and that's why I called and informed him that that's what we were going to be talking about on the air.
Oh, that was Ms. Fitzmaurice calling.
Unfortunately, just about everything regarding that subject happened before I made that call.
Oh,
and
boy.
You didn't really talk about it after I informed him. So they're probably wondering when you're going to talk about that.
I see. So
if you want to, you could talk about it.
You know, I want to talk about it, but I want to talk about it in a more informed fashion with guests who actually either have been driven off the land, who are homeless,
or... Well, let's just put the questions out there. I mean, is that
all right,
what
I guess I can...
happened? Was this land...
Well, why don't you do that? Why don't you speak about that?
Sure. I mean, this is the rumor that we heard, and I'm sure that Dr. Leff or Tim Fitzmaurice could verify it or deny it, that that there were some machinations to make that land declared excess property so that Leff and Fitzmaurice, one or the other, could buy the... I think it was Dr. Leff that bought the property, what we heard, this place is where homeless people had camped traditionally for at least the last 20 years. And the only thing that the police could do is they could go in after 11 and say, ticket them for sleeping on the property. But if they make it private land, then homeless people trespassing on the property could be repelled from that property 24 hours a day. And we heard that Tim Fitzmaurice and his wife had gone out and ordered homeless people off of that property. Also, we also heard that the property was purchased at sort of a song. But those are the allegations.